In 2013, Marissa Mayer, CEO of Yahoo, received a compensation package worth more than $200 million, mostly in the form of performance-based pay. As Yahoo's share price rose, Mayer was rewarded with millions in restricted stock, stock options, and bonuses. But is Mayer, or any CEO for that matter, really worth $200 million? Michael Dorff, a professor in corporate law, argues that CEOs are grossly overpaid. Today's CEOs make seven times what they made in the 40s and 50s. And while companies think they can motivate CEOs to boost company performance by tying compensation to results, Michael Dorff argues there is no evidence that performance-based pay actually works. Michael Dorff challenges the myths surrounding corporate pay in Midday's second hour, after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, our second hour here on WYPR. Dan Roderick's with you. In the financial collapse of 2007-2008, insurance giant AIG's stock prices fell by more than 98%, causing the federal government to agree to a $180 billion bailout. Michael Sullivan, AIG's CEO, was fired, but he walked away with a $47 million severance package. It was hard to hear that and not feel outraged that Sullivan ended up taking home millions while taxpayers bailed out AIG. But is it really fair to pin a company's struggles all on one person? And what about a company's successes? Steve Jobs, the late Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett have all been deemed innovative visionaries and become among the wealthiest men in the world. But if CEOs deserve less blame for a company's failure, do they also deserve less credit for its successes? CEO salary has skyrocketed since World War II. Today's median CEO pay is more than seven times what it was during the 1940s and 50s. Current CEOs receive eight- or nine-figure compensation packages, nine figures sometimes, made up of a small percentage of guaranteed salary, the rest coming from bonuses, stock options, and other rewards, all contingent on company performance. In 2008, CEOs of S&P 500 companies received only 17% of their compensation as salary, while the remaining was performance-based pay. Things didn't used to be this way. CEO salaries didn't used to be so high. The ratio of CEO pay to average worker pay was only 50 to 1 in 1980. Only 50 to 1 in 1980. In 2011, that ratio reached 380 to 1, but that was after a peak of 500 to 1 a decade earlier. It wasn't until the 1970s that performance pay took off. The theory was that tying CEO pay to company performance will motivate executives to increase share prices and produce better results. This seems obvious, doesn't it, that bonuses encourage hard work. But is there any evidence showing that performance pay has improved corporate performance or that CEOs actually have much influence on the company's results? Joining us in this hour of Midday is Michael Dorff, who teaches corporate and business law at Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles. He's also taught at the UCLA School of Law and Rutgers. Michael Dorff's book is called Indispensable and Other Myths, Why the CEO Pay Experiment Failed and How to Fix It. It's published by the University of California Press. Thanks for joining us, Michael Dorff, on the Midday Show.
It's my pleasure to be here, Dan. Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's a really interesting topic. And whenever I get into this with people, someone will express outrage that so-and-so CEO made $27 million last year or $47 million last year. They'll also express outrage that the first baseman for the New York Yankees made $20 million last year. And I'll right. always say, well, if the first baseman didn't make that money, most of that money would have gone to the owner of the company, right? So if he only made $10 million, the other $6 million probably would have gone to the owner of the New York Yankees, or the baseball team, or here the Orioles, or something like that. So we always say about the CEO, yeah, express outrage, but isn't he getting what or she deserves?
Well, that's the core justification, I think, for CEO pay is that CEO talent is rare, that the kinds of people who have the education and experience and drive to run a multinational corporation is rare. And so it's just a market that's operating. There are there's a very small supply and there's tremendous demand. And so the price keeps going up and up. And that's a nice theory. A lot of these theories that justify CEO pay, there are quite a few versions of the idea that the market is efficient for CEO pay. A lot of them sound very intuitive and correct on the surface level. The problem is that when we look at the data and try to see over the long term whether the data matches the explanation, we find that the data does not match those explanations very well at all.
Especially when you look at performance-based mechanisms, right?
That's absolutely right. So when we look at this historically and go back to the beginning of the data, which is really the late 1930s, early 1940s, when we first have publicly available data on CEO pay, we find that CEO pay looked very different in both structure and amount in the prior generation than it does in the most recent generation. So you go from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s, CEO pay looks radically different than it does today in both structure and amount. So in terms of structure, almost all of CEO pay was straight salary. There was a little short-term bonus, you know, one-year bonus type, where the triggers are based on 1 year's performance. But for the most part, it was just a salary. So none of the forms that we take for granted today, stock options, restricted stock, what we call long-term bonuses, really they're tied to a 3-year performance trigger. It's not very long-term, but what companies call long-term performance bonuses. Now, those were almost unheard of during that period. It wasn't that they couldn't have thought of them or they weren't in occasional use. So it wasn't that they hadn't been invented yet. It was just that they weren't popular at the time. At the same time, the amount of pay in real terms, that is, let's take inflation out of this equation, in real terms was for the largest companies, remember that large companies tend to pay more than smaller companies, was about $1 million in year $2,000. So that's about $1.4 million in today's dollars. That's nothing compared to what those same types of CEOs are making today, where they're, a typical pay package for a company of that size would be something like, you know, $15 or $20 million.
Hmm. Here's something else that's sort of intuitive. Maybe you can help me with this. On the idea of performance-based mechanisms in these executive contracts, that it would seem to me that a CEO would be acting in the best interest of the company if his compensation was performance-based. Is that not correct?
It's again, a very intuitive idea, and I think the real danger of that idea is how intuitively appealing it is and how much it matches our experience in a lot of other areas of our lives. So I have two young children. If I tell my 9-year-old daughter, look, if you make your bed every morning, I'll give you an allowance every week, but if you skip making your bed, you don't get your allowance. Well, she's very likely to make her bed. So for something like that, like making your bed, mm-hmm. like laying bricks, like soldering circuits, paying based on performance works very well. And so it's intuitive to us that it would work well in other areas as well. Unfortunately, when it comes to really creative tasks or analytical tasks, really high-level intellectual tasks, performance pay does not work well at all. And there is a stack of psychological studies that show us that. One of my favorites was done by Dan Ariely and a number of co-authors. And Ariely went out to India, to rural India, where the kinds of money that grants, you know, the U.S. grants provide for this kind of research was actually real money. Because one of the problems with studying this sort of thing is we don't have millions of dollars to match, you know, the kinds of money that CEOs get to try to experiment with. But that money was actually a lot of money in rural India. And so what Ariely did was he did experiments at 3 different levels of rewards. So, there were none of the complicated agency problems that we have with corporations where we wonder, well, are boards really furthering shareholders' needs and all that? There was none of that with these experiments. Instead, he just said, well, you could either, by doing a series of tasks, you could potentially, if you did well, earn a reasonable amount of money. Or they did that with other subjects 10 times the base amount, and then with yet other subjects, 100 times the base amount. And with the 100 times in the highest reward area, iteration of the experiment, the amount of money that the subjects could potentially have earned was equivalent to 6 months' spending for those folks. That's an enormous amount of money. If you think about how much money you spend in 6 months,
yeah,
that's a lot, right? So you would be really motivated. And even a tenth of that, that's a lot of money,
yeah,
you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they found, two things that were really fascinating. For the kinds of tasks that we expect CEOs to do, the kinds of high-level analytical and creative thinking tasks that we expect CEOs to do, what they found was between the base level and the level 10 times as high, there was no difference in performance. So that's already shocking. You decuple the amount of the reward, and there's no benefit in performance. Well, that's pretty shocking. But then when they looked at the highest level, where you could have earned 6 months spending if you did really well, and performance actually declined on those kinds of tasks. So it actually got worse. So here you're spending 100 times as much in rewards and you get worse performance out of the subjects. Well, why is that? There we have a harder time figuring out. There are a number of theories as to why that might be. It may be that the reward is distracting. So you're supposed to be thinking about a new marketing plan, but instead what you're thinking about is how much money you would make if only the marketing plan succeeds. Or you might think about this is not an analytical task, but you might think about trying to shoot a basket from half court. And if you're alone in the gym, you might be able to do that because you're going to focus on your form and you're going to focus on how hard you have to throw the ball and where you have to throw the ball. And eventually it might take you, for me, it would take probably a lot of shots, but you might eventually make it. Try doing that now in front of 20,000 screaming fans and you're not thinking about your form anymore. You're thinking about how embarrassed you're going to be if you don't even hit the backboard.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to make it a lot harder to hit that backboard. So that's one theory. There are a number of other theories as to why this works, but the empirical data is quite clear that it's true that tying pay to the performance on these kinds of tasks at best is neutral for performance,
at best,
and at worst may actually degrade it.
So performance pay hasn't improved performance of companies over time, over these, how many decades are we talking about here?
Performance pay started kicking in the late
70s. Okay,
so we're talking about a generation. And so now we've got a lot of data on this and a large number of studies that have looked at this in a number of different ways. So you could do what are called econometric studies, where you compare companies that use more performance pay to companies that use less performance pay. And try to see, well, how are those companies performing? And we see the same things there that we see in the psychological studies. That is, the more performance pay you use, either the performance gets worse or the performance stays the same. We're not seeing improvements in corporate performance based on increases in performance pay. And sometimes we see degradations in performance. You could also look at broader economic data. So we could look at how large corporations' earnings per share have changed over time. And we find the pace of change over time, if you look at sort of decade averages, so we take out all the vicissitudes over time, that pace looks about the same in the 1960s as it has before we had performance pay, as it does in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and I guess the aughts. So we don't see with this new influx of performance pay, we don't see a sudden rise in corporate performance. And that's true for broader GDP data also. If anything, there's an inverse relationship.
I want to ask you this, Michael Dorf. We're going to take a break here in a couple of minutes, but I want to ask you this question. What do companies get out of a CEO? I mean, are companies, I guess you're arguing that they're overpaid. They may not even be necessary. They may be a bad investment. I'm looking at a photograph of Jamie Dimon, you know, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, very well compensated, he's a very high-profile figure. He testifies in Washington, goes down to Congress. He really looks the part. So, what do companies get out of a CEO? Has this just become a big bubble that's going to burst someday?
Well, it's interesting. If there is a bubble, one question with market bubbles always is what will cause them to burst and what will be the timing. But that's a separate question. What you're asking in another way is there anything that they're buying for this? And the answer is I think they're buying something, but not nearly as much as what companies think they're buying. So again, there have been a number of empirical studies trying to measure what a CEO is worth to the company. How much is the best CEO better than the worst CEO? And it's very hard to measure this because there are so many variables that impact a corporation's performance in terms of bottom line measures like stock price or corporate earnings. So if you look at the last 2 days, where, you know, yesterday the market was down some 300 points. Today it's down over 100 points. I don't have it up in front of me, but I know it was hurting before we started the show. Why is that? Well, some of that apparently is because oil prices have plummeted to very to something around $50 a barrel. And some of it is concerns about Europe, in particular about Greece. Well, neither of those have anything to do with what the CEO of Apple is doing today or the CEO of Chevron is doing today. And yet their share prices, I'm sure, are getting hurt as well. So should they be punished because, in particular, the CEO of Chevron, should the CEO of Chevron be punished because the market price of oil has plummeted to $50 a barrel or so? Conversely, when the price was up at $100 a barrel or $150 a barrel, near $150 a barrel, did the CEO of Chevron suddenly become three times smarter and worth three times more? So what we find is that the bulk of changes in share price and changes in corporate earnings are due to larger environmental effects and industry-specific effects that can't really be laid at the CEO's door. And I want to be very even-handed about this, as you were at the beginning of the hour, Dan. It's not just that CEOs don't deserve credit for these changes. They also don't deserve blame for these changes. Mm-hmm. And another thing that has come with this new mythology of what Rakesh Khurana called the corporate savior, this idea that CEOs account for 100% of the changes in corporate performance, is that CEOs are fired a lot more now. So average CEO tenure is a lot shorter now than it used to be. And I think that's a mistake that's had some bad repercussions as well. So it's not just that I think they're overpaid. I also think they're overly fired.
Michael Dorff, we'll take our break here and come back and talk some more. Michael Dorff is a professor of law at Southwestern Law School in L.A. He teaches corporate and business law, and he's written this fascinating book, Indispensable and Other Myths, Why the CEO Pay Experiment Failed and How to Fix It. We'll get into the how to fix it part coming up a little bit later on in the show. I welcome calls with questions for the professor, Michael Dorff. 410-662-8780 is our local number. Toll-free long distance for the midday show at WYPR is 866-661-9309. Send me a question by email, midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. Very interesting indeed. Michael Dorff, thank you again for being with us from Southwestern Law School in L.A. His book, Indispensable and Other Myths. I love the title. Why the CEO Pay Experiment Failed and How to Fix It, the Big Pay Experiment. Now, something I wanted to ask you about. In the 1990s, you point out in your book that Bill Clinton, in running for president, railed against the excesses in CEO compensation. And after his election, he signed a law that barred public corporations from claiming tax deductions for CEO pay in excess of $1 million. But there was a catch there, right? The tax law allowed a huge exception, and it's exactly what we're talking about today.
That's exactly right. And it's a classic story of unintended consequences. So Bill Clinton ran on sort of a populist platform on CEO pay. The CEOs were paid too much and they didn't deserve it. And therefore, we should cap the deductibility of CEO pay at $1 million. At the last minute, they added this exception for performance-related pay. This is Section 162M of the tax code, for the lawyerly wonks who are listening. And the performance-based exception has become the dominant form of performance pay. So one problem with the law was that the $1 million cap was not indexed for inflation. So $1 million in 1993 is not $1 million in 2014. So even that, although it has had in a way some restraining influence, I think, on CEO salaries, which I think is actually an unfortunate effect of the law, what it has really helped to do is encourage companies approve of companies using much, much more performance pay. And I should emphasize that this was happening long before, I mean, for about a decade and a half before the law came in. And in fact, companies pressured the reason for the change in the law, the reason for the sudden shift to add this exception for performance-related pay was that companies lobbied very hard for it because they were already using stock options.
Right.
And stock options are written into the law as automatically counting as performance-related, even though it's you have to really strain to find how stock options are related to performance, particularly to individual performance.
Was it also a way of separating the boards from the accusation that big salaries reflected cronyism, that, you know, if you have pay for performance, that's going to induce just better work?
Well, I think that may have been part of it, although if that was the goal, it hasn't worked very well at all. Lucian Bebchuk and Jesse Fried came out with a book about a decade ago blaming basically the whole CEO pay phenomenon on corrupt boards. I think they overstate the case pretty dramatically. But one thing they did do very well in their book was point out how poorly structured a lot of these supposedly performance-related pay structures are, like stock options. If the goal is to motivate individual performance by the CEO, they're really not calibrated to that very well at all. So the idea that you should justify CEO pay by saying, well, they earned it because they only got paid well because the company did well, that's really a misconception. And I've heard that from directors all the time. Directors mm-hmm. really believe that. They'll say, well, we don't care about paying this person an extra million or two because they're going to make us billions. And that's the core, I think, problem is this notion that, or one of the core problems, is the notion that whatever happens to the company is because the CEO did it. If you really believe that, then boards would be shirking their fiduciary duties by stinting on a few million dollars of pay and then getting the wrong person. They got to get the right person in there if they really believe that.
Mm-hmm. Boards can become starstruck, right? They can believe the candidate they picked is superior to all others, and you can make quite a splash by with extravagant compensation.
I think that's a very common and understandable reaction. I mean, directors are told when they come into the board that their most important job is the hiring and compensating of the CEO. So it's not surprising that they then, you know, they feel all this pressure. And then how are you supposed to tell? You have these finalists. They all have these stellar credentials. How are you supposed to tell? How are directors supposed to tell which one is the best? It's natural when you're faced with a decision with very little good information and you're told the consequences of getting it right are enormous. It's very natural psychologically to come up with an idea that you can really tell that the difference between your number one pick and your number two pick is the Grand Canyon as opposed to Eaton Canyon. Sorry, that's an L.A. reference.
No, I get it.
It's okay, yeah. So if you believe that, right, if you really believe that number one is so much better than number two,
right,
then of course you're willing to pay anything you need to get number one because you owe it to the shareholders to get the best possible talent for the company. So I don't think it's really board corruption. Of course, you can always come up with bad stories, but in terms of explaining the overall phenomenon of CEO pay and the changes that we've seen over time in CEO pay, it's really not a board corruption story. And one very clear piece of evidence for that is that in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, when we saw pay basically static, CEO pay was basically static, it was very common to have insiders on the board, that is, people who worked for the CEO, like the general counsel or the chief operating officer, who could be hired or fired by the CEO and whose pay was determined in part by the CEO. Those people were on the board deciding the CEO's pay.
Right.
Now that's very uncommon. Now the most large publicly traded companies, the only inside director is usually the CEO. So boards are much more independent. At the same time the boards were becoming much more independent, CEO pay was skyrocketing. So it's hard to square that historical fact with the notion that the reason for the rise in CEO pay is somehow board corruption.
Michael Dorff is our guest. His book is called Indispensable and Other Myths, Why the CEO Pay Experiment Failed and How to Fix It. It's published by University of California Press. So, Michael, I wanted to ask you about this. Are shareholders seeing the light at all? I mean, we've heard about say on pay, that phenomenon, which has started in the last few years. It's a completely advisory vote that's taken by shareholders at U.S. companies on compensation plans. We had in Baltimore, 3 or 4 years ago, Constellation Energy Group, the shareholders registered an opposition to paying the CEO of that company, then CEO Mayo Shattuck, his level of compensation, which I think was $15 million plus that year, after a year in which the company lost nearly $1 billion. You know, that was, I don't know, 2010 or 2011. Anyway, our shareholders getting hip to this and seeing that too much of a company's profits going to executive compensation?
Well, unfortunately, I'll say this. Shareholder say-on-pay is a fascinating idea, and it's one with a lot of potential. But everything really depends on the shareholders and what they believe. So even though it's advisory vote, there is some data, and we only have a few years' worth of data for this, but there is some data that suggests very strongly that companies care a lot about the shareholder vote. So on the rare occasions, and this is part of the problem, on the rare occasions when shareholders have voted these down, and again, these are advisory votes, so the board is free legally to ignore them. Boards have felt a lot of pressure to try to change the CEO pay package in a way to make the shareholders happy again. But again, we have to ask, who are the shareholders and what is their impact? So let's start with this fun fact. In the few years that we've had mandatory say on pay, between 98 and 99% of pay packages have been approved. So we're really talking about only a few dozen pay packages a year that are voted down.
Right. Yeah.
So again, that also makes us question the data on some of these. We're dealing with very few data. I mean, I don't want to get too wonky about this, but there's not a lot of information out there that we're measuring. So we could easily see some skewed statistics just because there aren't very many data points. But why are shareholders approving? You know, CEO pay has started going up again. In the last decade, in the first decade of this millennium, CEO pay was shrinking for a while and then went up a little bit. But, you know, overall that decade, it was up very little by historical standards, up maybe 8 or 10% in real terms. But then in the last few years, as the market has recovered, not surprising, right? You tie pay to the market. So when the market goes up, CEO pay goes up. CEO pay has again been rising much faster than inflation, and the exact number depends on which measure you use, but quite a bit more than inflation. So why haven't shareholders been revolting about that? Why haven't they been protesting that? And there are a lot of theories about why that is, but part of the problem is that they buy into this theory of performance pay too. In fact, they are some of the strongest adherents to performance pay. So shareholders often follow what are called proxy advisory companies, the most important of which is Institutional Shareholder Services, ISS. And so what are these services advocating? And they're advocating performance pay. And not surprisingly, these large institutional shareholders like banks and mutual funds and private pension funds, they're advocating performance pay too, because they believe, because it's intuitive, not because there's any data to support it, but they believe that if you tie CEO pay to corporate performance, the corporations will perform better.
Yeah.
So they also think that if you get getting the right CEO is worth the money.
Yeah. I could also hear people saying, well, maybe it doesn't work every place else, but it's going to work here because of that. The intuition, right. the intuitiveness of it is so strong.
Well, I think that's true. And there's also a lot of peer credibility for this. So everybody you know thinks the same thing that you do about mm-hmm. CEO pay. You know, when I go around, and I've done a couple of corporate board talks about this too, it's quite shocking to them, this idea that there isn't much empirical evidence. I mean, by the time I get there, they've hopefully read the book, or at least they've been told about the book, so they have some sense of what I'm going to say. But and it can be a little bit awkward with the CEO and the comp consultant in the room, but it's quite clear to them that everyone is doing this, and so it must be all right. And you know, this is, again, not a surprising thing. It's not about board corruption, or this is not a slam on directors. Directors are very smart. They're very sophisticated. But what we're dealing with here is an opaque market. It's a market where there's no natural correction mechanism. You never find out if you got it right or wrong. So you set up a CEO pay package, and you hire a particular CEO, and then you see the company either does well or does poorly. But there are so many variables that go into that determination of how the company performs that you never really know how important either the CEO and much less how the CEO was paid had as an impact on the ultimate corporate performance. So it's like the opposite of the weather. You know, meteorologists are great at knowing exactly how much they know and how much they don't know. When they tell you there's a 60% chance of rain, there really is a 60% chance of rain because they see very concretely whether they got it right or got it wrong, and they've got lots of years of data to correlate their studies, so they really know how much they know and how much they don't. But think, on the other hand, about like the housing market. So when you buy a house, how do you know how much to pay for your house? Well, You don't. You don't really know what that house is worth. It's worth what you'll pay for it. And it's a very thinly traded market.
You have
very
comparables.
Few people buying and selling.
You have comparable sales, right?
Right. So you look at other people's houses in the neighborhood that look kind of like your house, and you say, well, how much should people pay for that? But how did they figure out how much to pay for the house? Well, they looked at comparables, too. So everyone's cheating off everybody else's paper. So that works out okay if someone over there actually knew the right answer. But nobody knows the right answer. I mean, how do you measure the inherent value? I mean, there are economic answers. But how do you measure the – so with a house, actually, there is some kind of clear answer. With CEOs, the theoretical answer is what we call the marginal revenue product. I don't want to – again – what that means is what the CEO is contributing to the success of the company. But as I've told you, it's very hard to measure what the CEO is contributing to the success of the company. It's not in any way something that we can say with certainty even 5 years later that we know the answer to, much less in advance, because that's what boards are trying to do. They're trying to predict what effect the CEO will have on the company.
Right.
And I'm telling you, you can't even do it retrospectively. Doing it prospectively is really impossible. So when you don't know the answer, it's natural to try to seek some credibility from your peers, to cheat off other people's papers. But if everybody's cheating off everybody's paper, you know, you end up with lemmings running off a cliff.
Michael Dorff, just to review here, then you're saying the best evidence shows performance pay hasn't improved performance. CEOs don't have much influence on the company's overall results. Companies are probably overpaying their CEOs, and CEOs are generally a bad investment. Would you agree with all that?
Most of it. I want to be even-handed about this. So when I say that CEOs don't have that much influence over corporate long-term results, what I mean is they don't have 100%. Right. So the answer isn't zero. There are some studies that suggest they have no influence. I think that's overstating the case also. But the right answer is a lot closer to zero than it is to 100%. So we do need to have talented people running the company. I don't think we can just pull someone off the street and have that person run the company. And the studies that are looking at the importance of CEOs are comparing sitting CEOs to one another. So one of the reasons why we don't see much difference is because these are people with very similar background and training and experience who are doing similar kinds of things. They're trained in the same business schools to do the same kinds of moves. If you pulled in some random person off the street, we might see some differences there. But what I'm suggesting is that the market for CEOs should not be nearly as competitive as people think it is. For one thing, CEOs don't often move from one sitting CEO position to another. They pretty much get one shot at it. Most CEOs are hired from non-CEO positions. Something like 85% are hired from non-CEO positions. So there's not really this fear that boards have and that comp consultants raise of, oh, well, someone's going to buy up our CEO. They're going to go somewhere else. They'll go to a private company or they'll go to another publicly traded company. That really doesn't happen very often at all. We also don't see much of an international market for CEOs. Most U.S. companies are run by U.S. executives. Most Japanese companies are run by Japanese executives. And that's surprising because American companies pay a lot more. So why aren't we hiring the best German talent or the best Japanese talent? That doesn't seem to be happening much either. There just isn't much of a real market for this from which we could measure anything.
Michael, we're going to take another break here. But before we do, I want to take a call, and then we have some more calls lined up for folks who have questions or comments for you. Michael Dorff, his book, Indispensable and Other Myths, Why the CEO Pay Experiment Failed and How to Fix It. And we'll have to get to how to fix it before the hour's up. Let's take a call here from Annapolis. Don's calling midday. Don, go right ahead with your question or comment for Michael Dorff.
Hi, Dan. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
And I just think it's a little bit arbitrary to be bashing CEOs for what they make. Is Hillary Clinton worth $250,000 to $275,000 for a 45-minute speech? My attitude is, God bless them. If they can make the money, let them make the money.
If they can negotiate for these contracts, God bless them, Don says. Michael?
Well, so why am I picking on CEOs? Let me make it clear that the kinds of CEOs I'm picking on are not entrepreneurs. So this is not someone who built the company from nothing.
Kevin Plank of Under Armour here in Baltimore, for instance.
Sure.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that when someone comes to an existing corporation that's been around for 20, 30, 50, 100 years, that's already a huge success, that already has tremendous momentum, already has a set market position, it's very hard to make much of a change in that company. And so the idea of crediting the CEO for any changes that occur is very hard to justify empirically. And since the core justification for paying these CEOs the kinds of money that they get is based on the notion that they are causing the growth in the company single-handedly, we need to really rethink that. If the rationale doesn't match up empirically, if the rationale doesn't hold up empirically, then we should really rethink whether CEOs are worth this much. And again, the best evidence of this is that in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, when the economy did very well, when corporations were doing very well, these same companies were paying a fraction of what they're paying now in real terms. So what are we getting? So a lot of this is not looking at this from a silo perspective, but looking at it from the board's perspective or the shareholder's perspective as an engineering matter. Should we really be paying this much, or can we do better by corporations and by shareholders by hiring the second or third choice for a fraction of the cost? And I suspect we really can do better.
Just a note on Kevin Plank, the CEO of Baltimore-based Under Armour. I thought this was interesting to throw into the conversation. Earlier this year, his compensation was increased to $3.2 million. That actually was his 2013 salary. Because the company had a great year. Its stock price rose in that period some 80%, and it had a two-for-one split in March of 2014. Kevin Plank is very different from the CEOs that you're just describing. He is the company's founder, its largest shareholder. He has 20 million shares worth more than $2 billion. That's as of almost a year ago. But I was always interested in the Plank story because of his pay. His corporate pay, at the age of 41, he received a salary of $26,000, an amount he requested starting in 2008 because he thought he should be compensated based on incentives tied to company performance. More on that when we get back. I'll get Michael Dorff's comments. A short break here on Midday. Michael Dorff is our guest. If you have a question about his book on CEO compensation and what we've been describing here, it's way overrated and maybe a bad investment for a lot of companies, maybe most companies. Please give us a ring, 410-662-8780. The email address with comments or questions by email, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. My guest in this hour of the show, Michael Dorff, is a law professor at Southwestern University Law School in L.A., where he teaches corporate law. And his book is about CEO compensation, taking a hard look at the value in this for companies, for shareholders over the years. Indispensable and Other Myths is the title. You heard me mention the Kevin Plank example. It's quite different from what we've talking about here, but he did. He personally decided that his compensation should be based on incentives tied to performance, to the company's performance, and that's why he is where he is. Executive pay at Under Armour is set in part by considering net revenue and operating income, and they've had some good years at Under Armour. So that example quite different from the others that you cite, Michael.
So, yes, I think with entrepreneurs, we are talking about something very different because you're usually talking about, first of all, especially at the beginning, smaller companies where there's a lot more potential for the CEO to make a difference because there isn't this enormous momentum. I mean, you look at Hewlett-Packard, which is a hardware company, right? They sell computers. They tried a few years ago to change over into a software company. So they hired a software CEO, and that failed in about 6 months because you just can't change the momentum of a company that size in that kind of a dramatic way very easily. It's really hard to do something like that. Well, a startup is much more nimble and much more dependent on its leadership in order to decide whether it's going to succeed or fail. So from that perspective, incentive pay might make more sense in the sense that only that there is some relationship between the CEO's performance or a closer relationship between the CEO's performance and the company's performance. We still have the same problems, though, of whether psychologically performance pay works. Does it actually make CEOs perform better? And we're still stuck with the studies that show us that that doesn't work very well. I think one reason why entrepreneurs succeed, or one measure of which entrepreneurs are likely to succeed, is the extent to which they're intrinsically motivated rather than extrinsically motivated. That is, are they motivated because they have an idea and they want to see it implemented, or are they motivated because they want to see a big payday in 3 years? If they're motivated by the idea, which I think if you, when you look at entrepreneurs who are successful, you find an awful lot of them that this describes, then they're much more likely to succeed. They're not thinking about the money. They're not distracted by the fact that they own 20 million shares, and if they can get the price up, you know, another $5, that's, you know, $100 million to them. They're thinking about how can I make a better product, because they love the product and that's what they're working for. And I think that's, for example, Facebook's story. I think it's a mistake. It's a natural mistake, but I think it's a mistake to say that someone who already owns a big chunk of the stock needs more incentive. Needs to somehow that $3 million is going to make a difference when they already have when this guy already has $20 million shares
yeah.
in the company's stock.
Right.
Like, what more incentive pay
right.
does this person need?
Right.
So I think that's actually a mistake. But you can see that conceptually for smaller companies, startups, you can see why one would think that that would work.
Let me take another phone call for our guest, Michael Dorf. This is Ellen in Baltimore. You're on Midday. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Dan. Listen, you know, there was a kind of a bit of a hullabaloo fairly recently about the executive pay for nonprofit directors, who I would assume are kind of the equivalent of CEOs of for-profit corporations. And you had someone on who was basically arguing exactly the opposite, that they needed to have these top-paid people, even though it seemed to be wasting the money, you know, that people were giving, you know, for a cause.
Mm-hmm.
To these high-paying executives, and they were arguing that no, these high-paying executives actually, you know, made the whole thing more successful. So it seems to be like the exact opposite argument in terms of nonprofits.
It's interesting, yeah. Dan Pallotta was the guest talking about, because he's done a TED talk on this subject, saying why the criticism of nonprofits for spending money to make money, to raise money, and paying people well. Who run nonprofits well? Why don't we reward people for doing good in our community, working for charities? Why shouldn't they be compensated at a level commensurate with the amount of funds that they raise and the good that they do?
Right. And again, there's nothing conceptually wrong with that if it turns out to be empirically true. And I have not looked at nonprofits, so I can't really speak to whether that theory works with nonprofits in the way that I can tell you that for large publicly traded corporations, it does not work.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, I would have no problem. I think many people would have no problem with paying a CEO $20 million if you could prove that they really did generate $1 billion worth of earnings for the company, and that some other CEO would not have generated anywhere near as much money. Then I think as an engineering matter, as a governance matter, I'd be okay with that. The problem is that doesn't work for publicly traded companies, that the empirical data shows that there is no correlation between paying a CEO a lot of money or structuring it based on performance pay and the net result for the corporation. Now, for nonprofits, maybe that's true, maybe that's not true. If it is true, again, I would have no conceptual problem with that, but I would want to see some empirical data that showed me that it worked before I shelled out $1 million of someone's donation.
And Michael, before the last break, you mentioned looking at this globally a little bit, that most CEOs, American CEOs, work for American companies, Japanese CEOs work for Japanese companies. But on this question of CEO pay and pay for performance, how does this play out in other countries?
So that's a very interesting question. And until fairly recently, it was clearer than it is now. So if you look at other really developed economies that are comparable to the U.S., so you look at like Germany, France, the U.K., and Japan, if you exclude the U.K., is closer and closer to us, and they've always been closer to us than the other European or Japanese corporations. But especially in Germany and France and Japan, they do not use very much performance pay at all. Historically speaking, they have not. Recently, there has been more convergence. There's been an introduction of more performance pay. But Kevin Murphy at USC looked at this. So we've been talking a lot about, people talk a lot about in the CEO pay arena, why it is that executives at international corporations, at German corporations and French corporations and Japanese corporations, make so much less than CEOs at U.S. corporations. And Kevin Murphy just recently did a great study on this, and he showed that part of it is because of the difference in company size. U.S. companies on average are larger, but the vast majority of the difference is because we use performance pay and they don't. And when you take out the performance pay and take out company size, they look pretty comparable. So they have very different corporate governance structures, especially in Germany, and they have not, as a result, don't feel the need to use performance pay. And as a result, their CEOs get paid a lot less than ours. German companies are doing great, right? And yet they have very little performance pay.
Here's a comment from Nancy, one of our listeners, by email. Let's see if you agree with this, Michael. I have a feeling maybe you don't. She says, it seems to me it doesn't matter whether a CEO is good or bad at their job because they always have a huge payout if they are fired. And then they get hired by another huge company with more money. Is that something that really does happen, or do we just think it happens?
Well, the last part is certainly not true. That is, it's not true that CEOs move from company to company as a common matter. It does happen some, but about 85% of CEO hires are from non-CEO positions. So that part's not really true. It's not that they're moving from place to place. But it is true that CEOs do get paid a lot often, even when they fail. And that's true for a number of reasons. One is, in more recent years, there's been a shift to restricted stock. Restricted stock, unlike stock options, is worth something even if the stock price shrinks. It's also true that bonus triggers are often set rather leniently so that people can get paid bonuses even if the company doesn't do all that well. But again, my problem really with this question is the assumption behind it, and the hidden assumption or not so hidden assumption behind the question is that the CEO is responsible for when the company does well or does poorly. And to some extent, that's true, but it's not true to a very large extent. And I don't think the CEO should be punished. CEO of Chevron should be punished because the price of oil shrank in half. That's not the CEO's fault any more than I think the CEO should be rewarded because the price of oil doubled. Neither of those is really due to the CEO. So performance pay measures have not done a very good job. And this, again, is something that Bebchuk and Fried do a very good job of showing in their book from 2003, that these measures are not, they don't do a very good job of filtering out those things that are really due to the CEO from those that are not due to the CEO. And I think that's a real problem.
Hey, just quickly, Michael, we're just about out of time here. I noticed a story from Bloomberg just in the last couple of days about the growing gulf in retirement pay. They're citing Target Corporation's CEO, Greg Steinhoffel, getting a $47 million retirement plan as he leaves the company, and comparing that to the rest of us, you know, with our 401ks and whatnot. Is that something you looked at in the book? We're short of time. I was just curious.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's retirement packages are certainly a problem. I think they are a result of the underlying problem rather than a cause of the problem. So if you're set up as in a way to give 10% of the money the CEO makes to put in their retirement package, it's not surprising that 10% of a larger base is a lot more money.
Right.
But there are a lot of problems. I do talk about it in the book. I hear the music, so I know we don't really have time to go into this.
Well, it's been great to have you with us. I appreciate you being on the show today, Michael. I've enjoyed this book, and it's a very interesting topic. Indispensable and Other Myths, that's the title, Why the CEO Pay Experiment Failed and How to Fix It. We didn't do much on the how to fix it part, but maybe we can another time. Anyway, I thank you for yours, Michael Dorff. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to come back anytime.
Michael Dorff, a law professor at Southwestern University Law School in L.A. Thanks to Bagby Pizza Company for providing lunch for our guests and our staff today. Hope you enjoy the program. See you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richman, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.